This episode of the Signal 51 Chronicles is brought to you by Oscar's Pub, 6323 Kent Bowie Boulevard.
Roxo Media House.
A Signal 51 is police code for an investigation, a law enforcement proceeding that is a systemic and thorough attempt to learn the facts about a possible crime that is complex and whose facts and circumstances are generally hidden, at least initially, behind obstacles that can be coincidental and or man-made. Investigations methods are formal. I'm John Henry, a journalist. My partner is Jake White, a retired Fort Worth police sergeant. And together, we examine the difficult cases of law enforcement, both in Fort Worth and around the region. This is Signal 51. The show is designed specifically for a more mature audience. Some of the content is graphic and is not intended for younger audiences. This week on the Signal 51 Chronicles, dying by the hand of greed. Jake, I'm playing a little bit on the, I'm playing injured today. Should be on the disabled list these days. I've a little ill.
Little head cold, do you?
Something.
I can hear it.
Allergies.
Got the best of you.
I'm assuring everybody that it's not the Black Plague or leprosy or any of the other.
Oh, it is something contagious. So you've already prefaced it by saying it's allergy. So
exactly.
Thanks. Next week will be a great week for me.
Well, David Ward was a senior vice president for operations at John Peter Smith Hospital in Fort Worth. He had immigrated to Texas from the UK in the 1970s, and he was due to fly back to his native home for a trip in May 1997. Twice before, he had been forced to cancel his long-awaited reunion with family. But this time, it was, everybody thought anyway, definitely on. Family said there was no way he would have put it off again. But when his parents arrived to meet his plane in Manchester, David wasn't on it. His brother Michael instinctively knew something was wrong. Though he had to postpone two prior trips, he certainly would not do so again without calling. That just wasn't his nature. Unable to reach his brother by phone, Michael said he called police here to file a missing person report. The police, though, told him it was too early to do that. Police also told him that they could not enter David's home in the 5600 block of Blue Ridge Drive on their own. Michael then notified some of the staff at JPS, who got a locksmith to open the door to David's home. There, the doors were all secure, and his BMW wasn't in the driveway. But that's when police discovered the fate of David Ward. Police found him in his bedroom of his Eastern Hills home with his feet and hands bound with wire. He was dead, and foul play was immediately suspected. Around him, his home had been ransacked and daubed with gangland graffiti. A postmortem report later revealed he had been tortured for several hours. Michael told reporters in 1997, "When you're raised in a close family environment, you can tell when something is wrong. It's like a sixth sense." David had grown up as the eldest son in a closely knit family in Lancashire. Michael said, "When I picked up the phone and they asked if it was me, they didn't need to say anything else. I could sense something was wrong. Perhaps the hardest thing I've ever had to do in my life was explain to my parents what had happened." Less than 12 hours from the time of his mother's call from the airport, Michael was on a plane heading for Texas. He said, "On the flight, I didn't feel anything. I was numb. I was still trying to reconcile in my own mind the events that had taken place. It's totally foreign to anything you've ever experienced before. It wasn't a natural death for which you could have prepared." David was said to be a fiercely hard worker. His career took off, and by 1995, he was a hospital vice president who had raised millions of dollars for AIDS sufferers. David immigrated here in 1975 for the same reason many others do: opportunity. There was a shortage of nurses at the time in the U.S., and David answered that call, and he climbed the ladder quickly.
David's friend, Greg Asher, arrived at 11:30 that morning to take Ward to the airport, but when he arrived, he received no answer at the door. Asher stayed at the home for about 15 minutes, but he ended up leaving after not hearing anything from David. When David did not arrive in England as planned, That's when worried family members called Fort Worth police for a welfare check at his home in the 5600 block of Blue Ridge Drive in the Eastern Hills neighborhood. When police arrived, they found no signs of forced entry or any sign a crime had occurred, so they left the scene. David's family, though, was still worried that he may be in danger, and that's when they called friends in Texas. They said, if necessary, call a locksmith to get inside Ward's home. Asher was one of the friends and was one of the people that entered Ward's home once it was unlocked. He said, quote, David kept his house immaculate. When I first walked in, I didn't notice anything wrong. Then I saw the black spray paint near the staircase. Once I saw that, I got a chill. Fort Worth police were called back to the home where investigators found the deceased body of 43-year-old David Ward. Evidence indicated Ward had been manually strangled and his hands and feet were tied with wire from the home. Investigators noted there were signs of foul play. Items were missing from the home, including Ward's 1993 BMW. Investigators also observed the spray-painted walls. The misspelled words read, quote, 60, pay your debts, debt spelled D-E-T-T-S, quote, down with mines, M-Y-N-E-S, end quote, R-C-S. A police spokesman said, the spray painting on the walls lends itself to all kinds of possibilities. There is no obvious message. We just have to continue doing a lot of digging in this investigation. Ward, he lived alone. He had a roommate previously, but the roommate had moved out approximately 1 year before. Police had been to Ward's home several times in the previous years on domestic disturbance calls, and also in 1996, Ward was the victim of a burglary and robbery. A day later, between 10:15 and 10:30 p.m., Ward's BMW was found burning in the 3600 block of Shady Valley Drive in Arlington. A witness reported a light-colored Honda Accord following the BMW. The same witness saw the driver of the Honda and the driver of the BMW speak briefly with each other. A short time later, the witness observed the BMW had caught fire. Witnesses also reported two men were seen leaving the burning BMW. Around the same time, short time after Ward had been discovered, police also identified a person they wanted to question about Ward's death. Travis DeHorney Jr. He was Ward's former roommate. 2 days later, Fort Worth police released a composite sketch of a man they believed had a role in Ward's death. The man was described as a slender white male in his mid-20s, about 5 feet 10 inches tall, who possibly goes by the first name of Aaron. Police obtained the description for the sketch after Ward's credit card was used at an Arlington restaurant the day after his death.
On May 24th, police had a break in the case. At 1 a.m., the Fort Worth PD Fugitive Unit arrived at Centennial Court Apartments at 700 West Mitchell in Arlington. The apartments housed almost 1,000 University of Texas at Arlington students. An arrest warrant in hand for Aaron Christopher Fouts. As police were arresting the 24-year-old, a second suspect, Jamal Brown, 21, arrived. Both Fouts and Brown were arrested and held on $500,000 bonds. Brown led investigators to some of Ward's property inside the apartment. Police also recovered a stereo, a VCR, and numerous liquor bottles that were removed after David's death. So Jake, police go from thinking perhaps David's former roommate had knowledge, might have even been a person of interest in this case, to arresting two 20-somethings in Arlington.
They did. Again, we'll get into the technology component and how things have changed, but to start with this. So Brown, he was a student at UTA and rented a 4-room apartment at the Centennial Court Complex.
A big apartment.
It's a large apartment. Several residents in the complex described Brown as a clean-cut type of guy who owned a pet snake. Faust, on the other hand, he lived with Brown, but there's nothing to indicate he was a student at UTA, which that complex was predominantly student housing. The neighbors, they described the relationship between Faust and Brown as a, quote, unusual couple. Now, Faust, contrary to Brown's what was described as a preppy appearance, Faust was nicknamed Conan because of his large torso. He was most commonly seen wearing a bandana, t-shirt, and snakeskin boots. His forearms donned a tattoo of a Texas flag on one and a skull on the other.
Now he's back in Fort Worth, and he meets David Ward. And David Ward, by what I know at this point, introduced him to Hell's Angels, the vice president of Hell's Angels in Dallas, and the Mexican drug leader in Dallas. At one point, Aaron, he was doing construction work there, commercial type construction. At one point, the Mexican guy, his girlfriend locks him out of the house and he kicks the door in, and Aaron goes over and repairs his door. Just a little side story. And the people in Hell's Angels, do you know what an enforcer is? That's where he got, I guess, the nickname Conan. Conan the Destroyer.
Faust, he was no stranger to the law either. About 6 weeks prior to the murder of Ward, Faust was arrested in the Fort Worth suburb of Haltom City on 3 counts of assault causing bodily injury. The charges stemmed from a fight where he punched 2 women and a man. Faust, he was briefly jailed, but was released on a $2,200 bond.
9 days away from going into the Army, he goes to a friend's house and they party. They're drinking. And the guy's girlfriend is causing a ruckus and carrying on. I don't know the whole story as far as what all she's doing, but apparently she got mad at her boyfriend, whatever. And at some point, Aaron says something about her, you know, to tell her maybe to shut up or something. And she goes into a rage. She jumps on his back. She sinks her teeth into his chest. When he died, he literally had teeth impressions in his chest where she tried to literally bite a chunk of muscle out. He had a full set of her teeth impressions in his chest from her biting him, and at that point he punches her to get him off of him. She goes to some of the apartments and rounds up 3 cowboys. They're going to take care of him. And one thing I would tell anybody is, you know, if I had advice to tell somebody who was thinking of getting in a fight, my son was like, I don't care who you think you are, how tough you think you are, you do not want to even think about it. He was the last one standing when the police finally showed up, and he was defending himself. It was self-defense. He didn't start the fight, but he had to defend himself, and he was the only one standing when the cops got there, covered in their blood. He said, in a joke to me when I was talking to him about this, he said the guy was so scared, the cop, that he pulled out pepper spray and sprayed him in the face. And he says, do you have any chips to go with hot sauce? He'd been sprayed enough times with stuff, it didn't even bother him.
So going back to Ward's murder, though, what started to come out was the truth. On Sunday, May 18th, 1997, Faust and Brown went to Ward's home with the plan of, quote, borrowing money. Strangely, though, Faust told Brown to bring spray paint. Brown, not knowing David Ward, agreed to drive Faust to the East Fort Worth home. According to a police spokesman, he said, quote, David Ward would not give him any money, and it made him mad because he saw the credit cards in Mr. Ward's wallet when it was sitting on a bedroom chest.
This is the point where he goes to David Ward's house and says, you owe me $500. I want the money. And David Ward probably sees himself as a special guy at that point. And he says, I'm not going to pay you. And you know the rest of the story. He had no mercy. He didn't care about his, you know, excuses or anything. He was getting ready to go to England to see his family there. He had money. He wasn't a broke guy. But he refused to pay the money. And again, like I say, you know the rest of the story.
David not complying with the request to give him money angered Faust. Ward was forced into the bedroom and tied up. Faust took one or more of Ward's credit cards to a nearby ATM machine, but he was unable to get any cash. When Faust returned empty-handed, this is when he strangled the bound Ward, police said. Faust ultimately provided police with a written confession. In that confession, Faust said that his plan was to knock Ward unconscious so he could take the credit cards and flee. Faust also confessed to tying Ward's hands and feet with stereo wire in the house and spray painting the graffiti-style writing with purposely misspelled words. Now that's some stone-cold killer stuff. Not to mention, sounds like it's planned. Jake, what say you about this? Is this Faust indeed a stone-cold killer?
I think he was. So Faust remained in jail awaiting trial. On March 30th, 1998, Tarrant County Sheriff's Deputy Stephen Rose was scanning mail. One of the letters that he was looking at was Faust responding to a letter from a woman who went by the name Amanda Snowbunning. In this letter, Faust wrote, quote, since I'm an honest man, I did indeed kill a man. Now, if you remember, we talked about Faust getting previously arrested and was briefly jailed about 6 weeks prior to the murder of Ward. So when Faust was arrested that first time in March of 1997, he provided some insight on his motive. When Faust was locked up in Tarrant County Jail for the Haltom City assault charge, one of his cellmates was a guy named Paul Hammonds. Faust told Hammonds he knew a person he could rob for his BMW, credit cards, TV set, and other items. Also, he already had a buyer for the BMW in Mexico. Faust told Hammonds that Hammonds could have the intended target's clothing items because they were about the same size. Faust said if the man did not cooperate with the robbery, he would kill him execution style. And finally, Faust told Hammonds he would cover his tracks by writing gang signs on the wall to give it the appearance of a gang-related murder.
Almost a year later, in April 1998, the capital murder trial of Faust was underway. After several weeks of testimony, the jury deliberated. After just 2.5 hours, Faust was convicted and sentenced to death. The jurors in post-trial interviews said they were, quote, unnerved by the cold, calculating, avarice-driven actions of this defendant. More chilling still is weeks before Faust's 1999 execution, he said, quote, I'm not going to say I'm sorry because I'm not sorry. Faust described Ward as a, quote, snobby Englishman. And he went on to say, quote, sometimes I wish maybe I could feel bad about it, because maybe I'm supposed to, but I don't. In April 1999, Faust was put to death for the murder of David Ward.
So that's kind of a quick turnaround for an execution. Less than 2 years.
Yeah.
One of the things that came out was Faust, after convicted of capital murder, waived all of his rights to appeal. He accepted his punishment. No appeal, and that's how quickly the process moved. I don't know that it would work that way today. We're going to get Sean to weigh in on that, see what his thoughts are.
Also reminds me of the execution of Timothy McVeigh. He did the same thing on the federal level.
Yes.
Guy who bombed the Oklahoma City terrorist. He waived all his appeals, and it wasn't within 2 years, but it was within 5 or 6.
I think it goes back to that stone cold mentality. I don't know. Here's one of the other things, though. So 2 years, in less than 2 years, Faust executed. What hasn't happened yet is the trial of Jamal Brown.
2 years later, we still haven't got to Jamal Brown.
Still have not got to him yet.
All right.
So it wasn't until June of 1999 that Brown had his day in court. Brown's defense attorney, a Houston-based defense attorney named Paul Nugent, said Brown was a coward, but not a killer. Brown's defense team said he allowed Faust, now dead, to stay with him for a few days in 1997. His defense team further stated Faust invited Brown to Ward's home on May 18th of 1997 to drink beer. When they got to the house, Faust asked Ward for a syringe so he could inject steroids. Ward obliged and provided Faust with a syringe. As the night wore on, though, Ward asked Faust and Brown to leave so he could go to bed. Remember, he's a hospital executive. He has a level of responsibility in life, and getting hammered on a Sunday night before you're going to England, probably not the best idea.
No, it's not.
But according to trial testimony, quote, "That's when the nightmare began," said Nugent. Faust grabbed Ward and forced him to a downstairs bedroom. Brown looked on, stunned. Faust tied up Ward with some stereo wire and stole an ATM card, or multiple ATM slash credit cards. After taking the ATM card, Faust left the house in an effort to withdraw cash. Brown was left behind with the tied up Ward.
All right, hold on a second. So Brown was left behind. So that means that without Faust.
Mm-hmm.
So our defendant in this trial, Jamal Brown, had the time and opportunity to free David, is what this looks like, huh?
He did. Said his attorney, quote, "He had a chance to save David Ward's life, and that's a regret he's going to have to live with for the rest of his life." When Faust returned, he was angry. It was then that he wrapped his arm around Ward's neck, choking him to death. Faust then, quote, "dropped him on the floor, and he stood there and smiled, admiring his work," according to Brown's attorney. In Brown's trial, it was revealed that it was Brown who spray-painted the graffiti on the wall to make it look like a gang-related killing. After a multiple-day trial, Brown was also convicted for his role in the death of Ward.
Murder, huh?
Nope. So he was convicted of a lesser-included offense of robbery with a max punishment of 20 years. But there's an oops in this case. So after the trial, the jury foreman said some of the jurors believed there was a possibility the reduced charge would also carry a life sentence. Had they known differently, they may have also convicted Brown of capital murder. After the conviction of robbery, the prosecutor was certainly not happy. Not happy with the possibility of Brown only getting a max of 20 years. So they're taking another bite of the apple. So after the conviction for robbery, the prosecutor, Alan Levy, said he was, quote, "disappointed with the verdict and pledged to file additional charges against Brown." He said that he hopes the arson charge, along with others he is considering, will significantly increase the time Brown serves in prison. And he actually gave a number when he said, "I'm kind of looking for something in the 40-year range."
I wonder how often that happens.
I don't know. Let's get Sean's thoughts on that.
That jurors screw it up.
You know, John, my favorite bar in West Fort Worth, little place called Oscar's Pub.
Never heard of it. Where is it?
6323 Camp Bowie.
Oh, I do know this place.
Yes. I have been told and have experienced they serve the best cocktails in West Fort Worth.
Pretty tasty.
And at a price that can't be beat.
Cannot.
And a staff that could not be more friendly.
Ugh. I'm telling you.
And when you walk in there, they made a show. They made a TV show in the early 80s, mid 80s. Very much a resemblance.
Heard about it. You're talking Cheers.
It's the exact same thing. You walk in.
Where everybody knows your name.
Everybody knows your name.
Telling you what. Also, it is a very friendly place. In fact, there's an order there. It says, or directive there. It says, be nice or leave. That's how friendly this place is.
And they mean it, too.
Oh, yeah, they mean it, too. And I'm telling you what else. Do not sleep on those tacos in that taco truck that sits right outside.
No, sir.
I've had tacos and burritos there. I think it's Gordo's taco truck out there, and it is...
they're good.
It is good. They're really good. I mean, even if you don't want to go, even if you don't want to... Like tonight, I'm got to go back to the office, and I'm going to swing by there and not drink 1 ounce of liquor. I'm just going to get a burrito.
Get a burrito.
Get a burrito and say hello to some people.
Get back in front of the keyboard.
Exactly so. So, Oscar's Pub, 6323 Camp Bowie Boulevard. Be there or be square.
All right, so with us, we've got our resident legal expert, Sean Furkey.
Our legal authority.
Yeah. Now, we've got Sean on the phone today as he's out gallivanting around the Metroplex preparing for his New Year's Eve festivities.
Oh, yeah.
Getting ready to watch TCU.
Go Frogs.
Demolish Michigan tomorrow. I don't, maybe.
Right. Wreck them. Gig them. Whatever.
Whatever it is.
Knuckles up.
Riff for him.
Rip, lickety lickety.
This can go on forever.
Yeah.
Okay, so one of the things that we talked about was this idea of it's really a jailhouse letter where a Tarrant County deputy, Stephen Rose, was reading mail, and Faust was responding to a jailhouse letter that he got from Amanda Snowbunny. And in that letter, he confesses to her. So we've got a couple of things with that I want to go over with Sean. Number one, Faust is incarcerated. The deputy opens his mail where he had presumably sealed the envelope. It was a private writing. Sean, give us an idea of how the Fourth Amendment applies to an inmate.
So obviously when you're incarcerated, you know, the expectation of privacy that, you know, everyone enjoys in the free world really is not applicable when you're in jail or when you're in prison. You know, as any inmate knows, as any good defense lawyer would advise them, any telephone calls they're making are recorded. You know, any mail that they're mailing out or mail they're receiving can be looked at. So, you know, you really don't have the expectation of privacy that you could try to invoke if you're out in the free world. So the fact that he, you know, basically confessed to this crime in a letter that he was sending to his love interest, and the sheriff opened this up, I mean, he really did not have the expectation of privacy that you and I would enjoy.
So I guess kind of a side note, his defense attorney seemingly makes an argument that he did have an expectation of privacy. Is that just kind of a step that he's taken that's saying, hey, I'm working for my client?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the defense lawyer, you know, he's got to make an argument on behalf of his client. He's, you know, got a constitutional responsibility to represent him to his, you know, the best of his or her ability. So, yeah, he's got to certainly make the argument before the judge. But, you know, clearly in this case, the judge made the right ruling because, you know, to me, it'd be akin to, you know, had he made that confession or admission on a jailhouse phone call. I mean, you know, same thing. I mean, they just don't have the expectation of privacy, you know, and again, you know, I'm sure his lawyer had advised him of that. I guess he just had the love blinders on trying to impress his little pen pal. But, yeah, there's, you know, that. The defense lawyer did what he needed to do, but the judge made the correct ruling.
All right.
So let me ask you this, Sean, right quick. So let's say that this fellow Faust is talking to another inmate, and a guard overhears him say that he killed a man.
Yep.
Is that hearsay or is that admissible? Would that be admissible, do you think?
Well, it would be hearsay, but it would fall under one of the exceptions. It would certainly be admissible. And that happens all the time in prison, you know, where these inmates, whether they're trying to, you know, blend in or, you know, get some credibility from other inmates, mm-hmm. Well, they'll start talking about the crimes that they're accused of committing and start admitting the stuff that they've denied up to that point. Either typically what you see what happens is that, you know, a fellow inmate will flip on them, will go to the guards, gets the, you know, assistant district attorney and basically offer to cooperate and testify against that individual or to, you know, kind of sweeten whatever sentence or, mm-hmm. you know, deal that they're potentially facing. But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, that certainly if a guard were to overhear two inmates discussing, that's certainly something that would be admissible at trial.
So in this one, that was one of the other things that came up. So a couple weeks before Faust's arrest for the murder, or a couple months, I'm sorry, before his arrest for the murder of David Ward, he was locked up in Tarrant County on an assault charge, three assault charges out of Haltom City. Cellmate was a guy named Paul Hammonds. So 6 weeks prior, he tells Hammonds, hey, I've got a target that I'm going to rob, and I'm going to steal possessions from his house. In fact, I'm going to steal his BMW, and I've already got a buyer for the BMW in Mexico. And when I do this robbery, I'll give you his clothes because you guys are about the same size. So Hammonds in Faust's trial also ends up testifying. Now, when we look at those jailhouse conversations, I guess from a prosecution perspective, I mean, from an investigative perspective, you've got to be a little bit careful because there's incentive or there's motive to talk, right? Sure. So if you're the prosecutor on that, you're looking for other facts to corroborate what the cellmate in this case is saying, right? I mean, you're not going to take
I mean, you're not going to take his gospel, you know, anything or, you know, another inmate might say, because obviously they've got motivation, they've got incentive, and that happens all the time where they try to claim, oh, so-and-so told me this. So certainly the prosecutor, their investigator, they're going to listen to that, but then they're going to have to do other, you know, research, investigation to corroborate that. You know, you're not going to just rely upon a statement like that. I mean, you would certainly need to find other evidence to support whatever that inmate is purporting to tell you that the you know, accused told them in jail.
That's some good info. So one of the other things that happened, so Faust, he's convicted of capital murder
okay.
in 1998, not even 1 year after the offense, April of 1998. After he's convicted, he's sentenced to death. He waives all rights to appeal, and by April of 1999, he's executed.
Okay, he's gone.
That quick, less than 2 years after the offense had occurred.
Okay.
When we look at the appeals process and death penalty cases, those drag out for a decade or longer, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, it's a lot of people, regardless of where you fall on capital punishment, a lot of people that are, you know, for it will make the argument, oh, I don't want my tax dollars to keep this defendant alive for the next 20, 30, 40 years of his life. You know, let's give him the needle. Well, in actuality, with all the appeals, the appellate process that takes place and the time that it takes, it actually costs a lot more to try to put a needle in someone's arm than it would for that person to serve out their natural life in prison.
Right. Now, I would think that his defense attorney has got to be telling him to the contrary. Don't waive your appeal rights.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, because like I said, I mean, not that his conviction in this case would have been overturned, but yeah, I mean, the attorney obviously has, fiduciary responsibility to his client. So even if he's appointed, you know, he's got to represent to the best of his ability. And any attorney, you know, worth their own would certainly advise their client against waiving any appeals that they would be constitutionally, you know, afforded. Sounds like in this case, this guy was, you know, he knew he had done it. He sounds like wasn't remorseful for it, was ready to check out. So that's, you know, his prerogative. If he wants to waive right to all appeal, I mean, the defense lawyer can do everything he can to advise him against doing so. But at the end of the day, it's going to be the defendant's call.
Yeah. And I think remorse was the last thing that Aaron Christopher Faust had.
Yeah. In fact, his last words were, adios, amigo. See y'all on the other side.
Wow.
Not much remorse there.
Kind of a major league asshole we got on our hands.
I think so. So the next guy, so remember there's two. There's Aaron Christopher Faust, and there was Jamal Brown. So yep. Brown, he goes to trial in June of 99. So he goes to trial some two months later after Faust is executed. And he was charged with capital murder. Now, during his trial, the jury finds him guilty, but not of capital murder, but of robbery. Now, a robbery indeed. They committed a murder, but they certainly committed an assault during the commission of a theft. So the robbery on the surface sounds like it would be in line, but it was a lesser included offense. Now, lesser included offenses is something that we've seen very, very recently here.
A couple weeks ago.
We had the trial of Aaron Dean, mm-hmm. the former Fort Worth police officer who was charged with murder but later convicted of manslaughter. When we look at these lesser included offenses, kind of walk us through what's the steps, what's the process, how does that happen?
So the way these lesser included offenses typically come about is, you know, in this case, you know, this guy was charged with capital murder. That's got certain elements of that offense. For a jury to consider finding a defendant guilty of a lesser included offense, that's something that evidence has to come forth at trial, and that has to be an instruction that the judge gives to the jury. Like in this case, I mean, it wasn't like this guy was indicted for capital murder, assault, robbery. I mean, he's indicted for capital murder. But if certain evidence comes about in trial, which in this case, obviously, a lot of those elements, you know, capital murder that led to that killing, you know, there was a robbery, there was an assault, the judge can give lesser included offenses for the jury to consider via his or her, you know, jury instructions. So that's how that comes about. And then the jury can consider those lesser included offenses. So in the case that we've all seen recently with Officer Dean, you know, he was charged with murder, but he was found guilty of manslaughter. So the jury, for whatever reason, and I didn't follow that trial too closely, but for whatever reason, they felt that the state did not prove all elements of murder, but they felt that, you know, that Officer Dean was guilty of the lesser included charge of manslaughter.
So in the Ward case, like I said, Brown gets convicted of robbery, not capital murder.
Right.
One thing that came to the surface was, we called it an oops moment, if you will, and that is after the trial, and you can click maybe shed some light on this, the jury foreman goes on record and says, hey, we didn't know that the robbery only carried a 20-year max sentence. So there's kind of a two-part to that. One, after the trial, you as an attorney, prosecutor or defense attorney, how does that work where you guys talk with the jurors?
So in some cases, the judge, assuming the jury's willing to do so, will allow both sides, the prosecution and the defense, to basically, you know, visit, interview with the jury to kind of see, you know, the discussions that they had, the thought process that went into them coming up with their ultimate verdict. So, you know, you basically, again, assuming the jury is willing to do so, and they're not required to do so, but you'd be surprised how often they're willing to talk to both sides and kind of explain how they, you know, ultimately came to the decision they came to. So it must have been during that discussion that that obviously they shed some light on that. Now, in this case, when the jury said, oh, well, we didn't realize, you know, there's several issues to come up there. There's the issue, okay, well, can the prosecution try to appeal that and say, hey, look, they would not have found him guilty of robbery had they known that it would only have, you know, given him up to 20 years, because, you know, the way it works with double jeopardy, in that case, since this individual was, you know, indicted and charged with capital murder, not robbery, you know, wouldn't like double jeopardy attached to the robbery charge. So, you know, the prosecution could make an argument that, hey, you know, jeopardy had not attached. This is what they communicated to us after. You know, we want to appeal this based on the sentencing and based on the thought process they went through. And in my opinion, they'd have an argument to make. I mean, ultimately, the decision would lie on the judge. But
so one of the approaches the prosecution took, and I mean, I can't think of a recent example or really any example. So Brown's convicted. He gets an up to 20-year sentence. The prosecutor goes on record and basically says, hey, we're not happy with that. And in fact, we're going to go back at him again. And this time, we're going to try to have him indicted for arson because they burned
David the car. Yeah.
They burned the car. How often does that happen from the prosecution side? So you get the actor gets convicted.
Right.
But the sentence is too lenient, or there's some other factor that the prosecution goes back for more. Was that something that you saw much in your time as a prosecutor?
No, that's not something that transpired very frequently. You know, I think that's, you know, more the exception than the rule. You know, and it surprises me that, you know, in this case, that the jury found him guilty of robbery, not understanding, you know, the time frame that he would be, you know, potentially facing. I mean, that would have been discussed during, you know, the sentencing phase. And
right, that's what I was going to ask.
It's a little hard. You know, it kind of hurts the prosecution on appeal because obviously they have a, you know, record of what was said, and you know, it makes you wonder, okay, was that just one person that made that comment, or all 12 of them, you know, misunderstood? But to answer your question, Jake, it's very seldom that something like this happens where the prosecution's like, okay, what else can we potentially charge them with to get a more severe sentence?
And it would seem like a second trial would have its challenges.
Absolutely. Right?
Because we're talking, you brought up double jeopardy. I mean, there's going to be, I would assume there's some or many elements that you couldn't include in the first, from the first trial into the second trial, right?
For sure.
Yeah. So, you know, in the guilt or innocence phase of that, of the trial, you're determining guilt or innocence, obviously.
Correct.
The jury was given instructions that they could consider robbery as a charge of guilt
Right. Yeah. The judge would, it's through what they're called jury instructions.
Yeah.
The judge actually reads all these instructions to the jury before they begin the deliberation. So if the evidence comes forth where, obviously, the defense would argue, like, hey, you know, we want these lesser included charges included in the jury instruction. Mm-hmm. The judge would read that to the jury, and then, you know, they could consider that during the, you know, guilt innocence phase.
And never once in those instructions would the judge say, by the way, this carries up to a sentence of X amount of years.
No, that wouldn't really come out during the guilt innocence phase. You know, they would basically, you know, consider in any lesser included, and then once they find someone guilty of a certain offense during sentencing, that's really when you start discussing that.
Right.
Ranges.
Who really knows? I guess it really kind of depends. But what if, while the jury's deliberating, they send a message to the judge and says, oh, hey, by the way, what is the sentence range on robbery? Would that be permissible, do you think, or is that a violation of something?
You know, I would think that would be, you know, something that the judge could answer. because obviously they're considering finding someone guilty of a certain offense, and they want to understand the ramifications of the punishment that offense carries. So I would think that's something. I mean, during the guilt innocence phase, that's not typically broached by prosecution or defense. But I would think if a jury had a specific question, then the judge could answer that question and say, okay, well, if someone's convicted of X offense, this is the potential range of punishment that they face.
All right. Well, as usual, the insight is more than helpful and sheds a lot of light while we're going through these stories. And like, I think the other thing that's interesting is the bleed over, if you will, from, a case 25 years ago to today. I mean, here we are talking about a lesser included offense and the relevance that it had in a trial just 2 weeks ago. So I think it's cool having the opportunity for you to kind of explain to the listeners how and why that happens sometimes. So to recap this, I think it's clear to say there are villains, monsters, some crazy violent people in this world. Faust, I think, was one of them.
Yeah, something happened to him in the developmental years. Obviously, he got off on the wrong foot, it sure looks like to me. One of those very violent guys who...
Yeah, they interviewed his mom, and they also gave some background on him. His parents divorced when he was 4 and a half. I believe he lived in Iowa and then moved here at a young age. I mean, he had his, like I said, he was no stranger to the law. But I think with him, what really stood out was just how, I mean, he just openly really admits to everything. He had a written confession that he provided to the police saying what his role is, saying this is why we did it. From a criminal perspective, they weren't the, he was not not that any killer is a good killer, but he wasn't very good at killing people. Technology advanced again. Remember, the BMW shows up missing. If that happens today, within a very short time frame, Ward's license plates getting entered into NCIC, or the database that the police officers use on we call them MDCs, but they're mobile data computers in their car. The other thing is, we've talked about it before, the idea of the license plate recognition technology that's available now that many law enforcement agencies are using and many are beginning to see the value in. You know, we've got the company right here in Fort Worth, Inside LPR, that provides them. You know, once you look at the technology and you see or apply the same facts to today, who knows how quickly they would have been caught? Because I can almost guarantee you that at some point, if that plate's entered soon, they're going through one of the cameras. Now, the only difference is it looks like they dumped the car pretty quickly, but it's still going to give you an idea of, where these guys have been. I think you also look at cars today and who knows what abilities they have, whether it's, through the information from your cell phone, or even some of the cars probably have some pretty, or they do have some abilities to track.
Yeah.
So I think, we look at this today, it would have been, the outcome may have been the same. It just may have been quicker, but it doesn't change what happens. It doesn't change the fact that, there was a predator living on a, I guess we could safely call it student housing. If there's over 1,000 UTA students that live there, and you've got a predator right there in the mix. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the scary part of this. Ward, like we said, he scaled the corporate ladder pretty quickly. He started as a nurse from England, and, some 22 years later, he's the vice president of hospital operations at a huge hospital here in Fort Worth, the county hospital.
Yeah, and as far as evidence today versus yesteryear, I got to think that because some reports said that he was tortured for several hours mm-hmm. which means they were there for several hours, which makes me believe that there had to have been probably some DNA evidence left behind. Like, they had to have used the bathroom in there, probably.
Oh, yeah.
And so, now, of course, the police eventually got this thing, you know, it wasn't very long. It's in a few days that they found these guys.
That's the thing about these detectives back then. I mean, you know, we talked about it in the Glass Key murders, and in fact, this is along that time frame. If you remember in that story, 1990, there were 8 or 9 homicide detectives and, you know, a couple hundred murders in Fort Worth that fall on the shoulder of 8 or 9 detectives. But then the mid-90s roll around and things start to slow down a little bit. They're able to catch up. They're able to work on some of those cold cases. Here we are in this one, 1997, where it's significantly lower. The number of murders is significantly lower than what it was in 1990. But again, you look at that, it's the same detectives too, right? That whole squad at the time did not have much turnover. And, you know, they catch somebody, what, 2-3 days after the fact. I mean, they start from a call, a welfare check. They have no evidence of a crime. The family says, hey, you know, we need to get the door open. You guys need to go in if the police aren't, which I also, another similarity in what we saw in the Aaron Dean trial. It was think about it. The police get called to David Ward's home. There's no evidence of a crime. There was no open door. The time of day was different. It was 11 a.m. or whatever, but there was, you know, the call in reality is very, very similar. The police response then was, we can't go in the house.
Well, and there wasn't, like you said, there was no open door.
Yeah, there was no open door. They said there was no evidence of a crime. So they leave, and then the locksmith comes out. The friends go in, and they find the crime scene, and the police come out. But with, like I said, within 2 days, Faust and Brown are in custody. They start from nothing and work that quickly.
And one break was that conversation, the jailhouse conversation that Faust had with Hammonds. Was that Hammonds?
Well, that wasn't a break at the time, because Hammonds wasn't even in the picture at the time. The break, where the break really happened, was when they go to Arlington. They released that composite sketch about 2 days after the murder. So where'd they get the composite sketch identification from was from the restaurant server in Arlington. That's where that came from, because they tried to use his card. So the server was the one who was able to provide the description. Now, I think there was another person who was provided some information that led investigators towards the down the right road, if you will, in terms of apprehension. But
yeah, I think somebody who knew, possibly knew both.
Now, there was somebody who knew both, from what we could gather, and I don't want to go too far down the rabbit hole with that,
right?
Because we don't have
right. But he was able to look at that composite and say, "I think mm-hmm. I know who that is."
Yeah, because they had a name.
Right.
I mean, they, you know, that original release on the composite sketch was the description, and he also possibly uses the name Aaron. You know, aside from Aaron being a regular at, you know, whatever restaurant in Arlington it was, it's pretty unlikely they're going to know his name.
Yeah.
And that's another thing. You look at technology, there's probably no video evidence of them being inside at the time. It's amazing how quickly and how fast things have evolved. You know, now there's a video record of, you know, pretty much everything. I mean, there doesn't seem to be many unsolved murders. And then you look at the concept, you go even deeper, you look at the concept of like serial killers now, where'd they go? Look at the 1970s and now look, I mean, when do we hear about I guess we've had a couple of them. We've had a few of them here in Fort Worth and in recent time.
Last 2 years.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess they're out there, just not, they don't have the same, maybe the same coverage, or maybe they simply aren't as prevalent, or maybe they get caught sooner. Maybe there's a societal component that has slowed it. I don't know. It could be a combination of all. I have no idea.
Talk about the guy Jamal Brown, the accomplice.
Yeah.
Probably not a stone cold killer like Faust is.
No, I mean
he's a follower, right? I mean he.
Yeah, I think we're taking a lot of Brown from his trial testimony.
Uh-huh.
But let's look at the facts as a whole. He was a student at UTA.
Right.
There's no indication.
I think an engineering student.
An engineering student, indeed.
Yeah.
There's no indications of any kind of prior criminal history. I mean, I think a follower is a safe, would be a safe description.
I mean, he's alone with him he's alone with David Ward while Faust is out trying to get money by use of the cards. He doesn't release him.
No.
So he's scared to death of this guy, obviously. Faust is probably one. Fear is probably one element of the control that Faust has over Brown.
I think so. And I think, I mean, again, that it's got to be immense fear because he had every possible opportunity to either flee.
Yeah.
So I don't want any part of this because by all accounts, he did not know David Ward.
Right. He could have gotten on the phone right there. Not a cell phone, who knows, but I'm sure he had a landline or something there.
Well,
dialed 911, said, listen, I'm in a bad situation here, bubble, you know.
That goes back to what we've talked about, right? That goes back to the idea of people and their willingness to call the police. If you remember, we talked about the drug house robberies or the drug house murders.
They're afraid to call the cops because they're involved.
And at that point, was Brown an accomplice in a robbery? Well, by all accounts, he was.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy's bound with stereo wire. His credit cards are taken. And he does nothing.
Right.
So I could see why. I mean, just from my experience, I'm not surprised that he didn't call the police. But what I am surprised by was he didn't flee. And maybe there was that fear factor.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't flee because he was that scared of Faust. That's a possibility as well.
And not only did he not flee then or release David Ward, after they leave the house, he's still buddies with this guy. He continues to let him live at the house. Of course, we're only talking days after the murder.
Yeah.
But, he doesn't, by all appearances, doesn't try to extract himself from this friendship or...
He doesn't. You know, when police arrived at the apartments to arrest Faust.
Right. He wasn't there, but he shows up.
Yeah, he shows up. And when he shows up, he immediately says, I'm an accomplice to this. And he's the one that takes police inside where they find the evidence of the crime.
Right,
where they find Ward's property. I think it was 37 bottles of liquor and a VCR and perhaps the credit cards. I mean... That goes back to that the level of fear, because that is not normal. Brown makes zero effort to distance himself from the crime, which is unusual. I mean, he seemingly never once denies that he was there, denies his role. He does none of that. He just kind of falls on the sword and says, yeah, I was there. And so that's why I do think there is some element of truth in that defense testimony that he was a coward. And I think he did just get wrapped up with he gets wrapped up with this guy. Who knows what their relationship was? Who knows, what was said? Oh, well, I do. One of them was Faust did threaten to kill a family member of Brown. We've seen that before. We saw that in the Barry Leatherman case that we covered. If you remember correctly, it was Louis Ivory. His father said, Ivory only said that because
he had been threatened.
He had been threatened, and my other family members had been threatened. So it's a common theme. We've seen it before. I mean, and I'm sure it's, in some of our other stories, we may very well see it again.
Undoubtedly we will.
Well, I think it's time for a Oscar's pub visit, perhaps, as we conclude this episode.
Let's do it.
Oscar's pub, the finest pub in West Fort Worth, located at 6323 Camp Bowie Boulevard, yep. Serving some of the coldest drinks in town.
We're broadcasting today. It's actually the day before New Year's Eve, which means it's the day before the Horned Frogs, the TCU, play Michigan in the national championship semifinal. So we're wishing all good things for TCU tomorrow.
Yes, indeed. That's going to be huge for our fine city.
It is. Tell us before we head out, Jake, remind viewers, listeners, where they can find us on the socials.
We've got Facebook, Signal 51 Chronicles, mm-hmm. Instagram, Signal 51 Chronicles, your preferred podcast platforms. I'm going to say all of them. Mm-hmm. Signal 51 Chronicles, YouTube, Signal 51 Chronicles. Now, what's important when you listen to our episodes, whatever method that may be, on YouTube, you got to subscribe. Your social platforms, you got to like them.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty quick click of the button. Subscribing's that simple. Mm-hmm. All you got to do is hit that subscribe button down there in the bottom corner.
Tell your friends. Tell your family.
Friends and family. Co-workers. That, hey, Fort Worth got this Fort Worth crime show.
I know dogs that even might want to listen.
Yeah, there could be a few. And here's the thing. This is episode one of season two. Some of the ones that we have in store.
Got some good stuff coming.
We've got some real good stuff coming. We've got some of the stories that people may have heard, but from a different perspective. We've got some of those lesser told stories coming up.
Mm-hmm.
We're kind of running the gamut, you know, sadly for a true crime podcast, murder's kind of the crime that prevails, but we've got one at least so far that's
not
a murder. Death is involved, but not a murder. So please check us out. Please like, subscribe, and that will do it.
That's all we have to say about that. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Roxo Media House.